You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Before we begin, please be advised. This episode contains frank conversations about spiritual, emotional, verbal, and sexual abuse, as well as the systems that allow that abuse to go unchecked. It may also include occasional strong language. For some, these stories may be difficult to hear, especially if you've experienced trauma in a faith context. Many of the people I've spoken with, survivors and witnesses alike, are still carrying the weight of what happened. Some have been in therapy for years, and even now, telling the truth is hard. So if you need to take breaks or step away and come back later, please do. Before we begin, a quick note for listeners. Throughout the Spoiled Fruit series, I've shared clips from a wide range of interviews, voices that have helped shape this story and give context to what happened behind the scenes. But there are some conversations that deserve to be heard in full. Today, we'll start with one of those, my interview with Chris Sauter, former youth pastor at Duluth Vineyard. Chris worked closely with the Gatlin family, witnessed the early red flags firsthand, and brings a critical perspective on how systems of power and silence took hold within the church. Next time, we'll hear from Ryan Bowers, a former Vineyard pastor from another Duluth church, who is the first to formally alert Vineyard USA about Michael and Brenda Gatlin as far back as 2014. I'll continue to release full-length interviews like these throughout the series. Conversations that I believe help paint a fuller, more honest picture of how things unfolded. And for those of you supporting the show as exclusive subscribers, thank you. I'll have additional full interviews available for you soon. This is my full conversation with Chris Sauter. I think first and foremost, I think what's interesting, because the picture I want to paint here is that despite some of these larger scale scandals that have occurred and some failures, I think in how Vineyard was able to handle these things, was that most of the people who have ended up leaving Vineyard or are sort of dissatisfied with Vineyard at the moment, but maybe still in it, there was a very real reason that all of these folks were attracted to the Vineyard to begin with. And most of them didn't want to leave Vineyard. They wanted Vineyard to change and evolve, but were left no other option. But they loved the Vineyard, you know, and there's very real reasons for that. So I would love for you to start out with, tell listeners, first of all, who you are and how you first encountered the Vineyard and what first brought you into the Vineyard.
My name is Chris Sauter. I am a pastor at Neighborhood Church in Duluth, Minnesota. I got involved with the Vineyard. I went to a very conservative evangelical Bible college, graduated, got married, and started my first job in a small town called Amory, Wisconsin. And I was raised as a, what do you call those, in purity culture and as evangelical. So I was new to this whole idea of having sex for the first time, and it was amazing. So having a partner and then being in this church and end up being just an absolutely horrible, horrible situation as being a pastor. Very toxic environment. And so I was 22 and talking to my friends. I feel like they're all telling me what I wanted to hear. And I remembered that my partner went to Duluth Vineyard when she was in college. And I said, why don't we meet with Michael and Brenda Gatlin? They don't know us that well. They're pastors. And they could tell us if this is what church is really all about, then we don't ever want to be a part of the church again. So we met with them. We laughed. We cried. And they said, No, that is not normal. And we're actually looking for a youth pastor. You should come work for us. So actually, when I was visiting Nikki, my partner, Michael Gatlin found out I was going to school to be a youth pastor. And he said, "Hey, why don't you come work for me for free?" And I'm like, "Who the hell is this guy?" Well, then like a year later, I'm, you know, actually employed with him. And I got into the Vineyard because the whole idea of like the kingdom of God, not just being later, but it's also being present, was really, really, actually really new to me. And some of their values and some of their theological takes were vastly different from the evangelical church that I was raised in. And it felt very life-giving. And it was very, in my time, it felt very progressive, which felt kind of scary, but was scratching something inside of me that it has always been. I just didn't have language for it. And so when we started at the Vineyard, it was like 200 people. And it was great. But you want me to talk about why I got in it? Michael and Brenda are intoxicating people. They can work a room and they make you feel alive. They make you feel special. They make you feel seen. And honestly, like walking into that church on a Sunday, it felt vibrant and people wanted to be there. We do like weekend workshops where people would come for like 4 hours on a Saturday morning and then come back for church. And Michael, one of the best things Michael did was that he could, it's like a trigger word now, but he could cast vision. And I learned a lot about it. He could walk into a room of all these pastors, hundreds of pastors, and say like, "I want all of you to commit to planning 10 churches in 10 years. And I want you to commit this amount of money." And tons of people would do it. And Michael was never going to be able to plant that many churches. And those people weren't going to be able to plant that many churches. But Michael made them feel like they could. And so it felt really good to be working with a pastor who seemed like such a visionary leader. And I learned a lot from Michael and Brenda just about like leadership in general, like organizational leadership. They could lead a large team of people and they could run a really, well, it appeared that it was a really good organization, and I'm being terribly toxic. But I guess that's why I got in the Vineyard. And the Vineyard was, maybe I already said this, but like the forward facing progressive piece felt really good. And then honestly, when I started working there, the church really started to grow, and I've never been a part of an organization that grew so rapidly. And so in that evangelical setting, you feel like a rock star when things are growing, when other churches and other pastors are visiting you and saying, "What are you guys doing? We want to kind of like copycat this." You feel a little, your ego feels really pretty fucking good. And so I'm in an organization, the Vineyard, where we are now being nationally recognized. I'm getting invited into these conversations with, you know, who I thought were like movers and shakers in the Vineyard. And we grew up like in a matter of like four years. We went from 250, we were at like around 2,000, and it was wild. And the thing about it is, when you're in a system that a narcissist is a Christian narcissist, is that a way of speaking of someone? A white Christian narcissism. When they say, "This is the kingdom of God and this is what God is doing and I'm hearing from God, I feel like God is moving." Vineyard's very big on being able to identify what the Spirit of God is doing. And when they say, "This is God, this is what we're doing," you believe it. And when you see hundreds of salvations every year and you see new families joining up, you're like, "Oh, clearly God is doing something, because we have the fruit, we have the receipts, here's the evidence." And the whole time, being an empire that was really built just for Michael and Brenda Gatlin, which we couldn't see at the time. But it felt really good to be relevant. It felt really good to be in those rooms.
It must have really caught the attention of Vineyard USA as well, because one of the things that I've learned as I've learned more about the Vineyard at large is that each church is responsible for reporting certain data every month in terms of how many baptisms have you done? How many people have you brought to Christ? And that sort of thing. And growth seems to be at the basis of all of it. So you guys must have been getting a lot of national attention as well to go from 200 to 2,000.
Yeah, they put out a map. I haven't thought about this forever. And they would put like who had the biggest growth when it came to salvations, or what did we call them? Salvations. And that little county in Duluth was like bright red. And I remember looking at that and saying, man, I helped do that. And it felt really good. And now it feels so like, please remove my name from all of that. But yes, nationally, and we'd have people fly in, like, I'm not gonna say their names. We would have people fly in and meet with Michael, and they'd pop in. They're like, you guys have such an amazing church. Thank you for letting us steal Michael from you for the next couple of weeks. And we're like, yeah, we did this. And we'd have to report just in our own, not our, we'd have to report at Duluth Vineyard, salvations, baptisms, small groups, new members. And we had to track everything because that is how you get attention in the vineyard.
Yeah, and along with that, I think, you know, we can't ignore the financial aspect of it too, because correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't the vineyard dues based on like essentially a sliding scale? So I would assume that you guys would probably pay more in dues as the church gets larger and, you know, accumulates more financial means.
Yeah, you have to give 3% of your operating budget. And so the more money you take in, the more you give. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I could see where that might be attractive, you know, to a church movement that essentially in many ways operates sort of like a corporation. Like there is a hierarchical structure, definitely a very numbers driven business model. You know, the types of statistics that they report on a monthly basis, you know, my day job is in the corporate world. That is exactly what we look at to determine, you know, how successful we are, is looking at like growth essentially, or like how to fix issues where we're not seeing growth. And so it seems like that would probably also be part of what kind of captures the attention of the national vineyard.
Yeah. And if like churches aren't selling a product, like selling widgets, what we are, the data that we're choosing on are these incredibly sacred, nuanced things, right? Salvation is a beautiful, beautiful concept. But when you reduce it to a number to get some sort of gain, or to, like for me, Michael told me the only way I'm getting paid more is if I get new families in. And the way you get new families in is by like having this great product, and these kids would commit their life to Jesus, right? They'd get saved. And then they would go back home and bring their parents. And so I regret, but at the time I was really good at getting people to respond. And at the time I really believed in it. But in the back of my mind, I also knew if I don't get more people, I only get paid $25,000. I want to make more than $25,000. And so I was really good at creating those kind of places. And Michael was outstanding at it. He was so good at it. Like even when we'd have Easter and Christmas and every funeral, we had salvation packets that we put in the very back by the doors. And there was always a salvation call. And we'd say, on the way out, grab one of those salvation packets. It's going to help you take the next step, blah, blah, blah. And then anytime one of those, we count all of them because we knew how many were there originally. And then we'd report those as salvations. And so we kind of like padded the numbers pretty, pretty, pretty good.
What's interesting about that too, and one of the problematic, I think, components to sort of measuring your metrics in that way is, you know, I was talking to another former Vineyard pastor, Melody, and she mentioned the fact that like, hey, like we live in the Bible Belt. There aren't too many people here who aren't aware of Jesus and who haven't already probably to some extent given their life to Jesus. And so you can't really count them as conversions in that way, you know? So like kind of more difficult there to find people who aren't already sort of in the boat, you know? And so it makes their job 10 times more difficult to meet those types of metrics because of where they live geographically.
Yeah, but again, you can name it whatever you want and still report it as a salvation, right? So if you have kids downstairs and the kids pastor leads them through the what do you call it, salvation prayer, even though they've already done it 17 times, they still report that one kid got saved 17 times.
Oh, wow.
So like, yeah, you can, if you want, I can't describe in the vineyard. If you're not relevant, you're just another church. You're just someone else. You want to get into those conferences. You want to get into those rooms with Rich Nathan and Jay Pathak. And there's only one way to do it is by getting attention, by being some sort of mover and shaker in the movement. And so it motivates you to honestly do insincere things.
So talk about like your initial experience. Like you come on board, you came out of already like a negative experience with the church. And as you said at the top, you were already in a position where you're like, man, if this is what church is, I want no part of this. And so really like, you know, coming to Duluth Vineyard saved that for you. And so you and your partner. And so you're coming into this, it feels magnetic to be a part of this, electric. At what point did you start to notice that maybe things were a little bit off?
Yeah. I'll share a series of stories that I recalled this morning while I was crying. My first week on the job, my partner and I went to their staff retreat, and it was at some Boy Scout camp an hour away. And it was super fun. And like we could drink beer, you know, which felt like so alive. And we were telling funny stories. And it came time to go to bed. And the ladies went to one side, the guys were going into another. And Michael pulled me aside. And he said, hey, why don't you sleep in the tent with me? And I'm like, well, I can't tell the boss no. I can't say, it's my first week. Like, I want to make a good impression. I don't want to go back to the kind of church I was at before. And so I felt kind of obligated to go. So I went into his tent and he started making small talk. And then he started telling me these really intimate, traumatic things that happened to him when he was younger. And the whole time I felt so uncomfortable, but I couldn't leave. And I just like shook my head and said, wow, that sounds really, really hard. And just couldn't wait to go to bed and then get out of there. It wasn't until therapy years later, I recalled that story, that my therapist was like, yeah, that's how grooming starts. They put this very sensitive, traumatic information that you feel in a way honored to hear it. But at the same time, I'm not your therapist. You're my boss. I'm brand new. I'm 24 years old, right? And it just felt, that was the first red flag that I ran through because I thought we were doing this for the Lord. Another one was many years later, and I gave a message on the in the auditorium, and I told people I don't like to be touched, and I tried saying in a funny way because I had so many people that want to come up and touch me. I don't like being touched without a purpose, and everyone kind of laughed at it. And on the next staff meeting, I'm sitting on the couch, and Michael makes his way, sits right next to me, and there's probably like 25 people in the room. And as Michael's talking about some bullshit, right? Nothing important, not talking about connecting, nothing about intimacy. He just puts his arm around me as he's just sharing this information and leaves it there. And I am sweating because that makes me so uncomfortable. I'm like, he was in that message. It was a big part of my point. And it was, again, he did that multiple times, not until therapy years later. That they're like, yeah, that's a signal to the rest of the crowd of who controls the bodies, who has the power. You see what I'm doing right here with Chris? And he's not doing anything. He's not moving. He's like shaking his head. This is the kind of power that I hold here. Then there's so many other stories of like, Michael and Brenda took it as a badge of honor to fight in front of us. It was like them trying to be like, we're badasses, we're vulnerable, the way we live our marriage, the way we pastor. And they would yell at each other, and she would break down crying, and she would like have to walk out of the room. And then Michael would turn and say, like, all right, what's next on the agenda? And we're like, what the hell is going on around here? He would brag about getting other staff members to cry. So before he'd walk into his office, he'd stop by and say, guess what? I'm going to get Jill to cry here. And he would. And he took that as a good, healthy leader. Another reason that, like, where I saw red flags is whenever someone on staff would leave, never got fired, they'd always like, God's calling me to go somewhere else. And in a matter of like a year, there was like 16 different either pastors or pastoral assistants. Oh man, bullshit names. Would left. And every single time, like our junior high intern, he couldn't handle it. It was horribly traumatic for him and his partner. And he resigned, and he went to Michael and Brenda, and I was there because I was the youth pastor. And he's crying. He's like, hey, I can't wait till I can talk to the students and share my experience. And I really love them. I invested in them. And Brenda looked at him and said, no, you're not going to do that. We're going to do that. We're going to write up an email. You can put a couple of your own sentences in, but we're going to control the narrative. And they did that with every single person who left because they were afraid. They knew that it was a toxic system. And to give someone the microphone, to give someone the church-wide email, they could broadcast something that doesn't center their best interest. That was a huge red flag for me. Of like, why can't you trust the person that we hired to pastor all these kids? And now they can't even be honest. And I highly doubt they're going to say horrible negative things. So this manifested in the worst way possible is when this married couple from a different country moved to the United States to work with the Duluth Vineyard. And they got paid $200 to $500 a month. They got to live in a really shitty house for free. And they got, Michael told everyone who came to work from our intern for him, at the end of it, you're going to get a letter of recommendation from me, which gets you in every door in the vineyard. Well, it didn't work out. They had a horrible, horrible experience. And leading up to when they were going to finally be done, one of them started sharing with their friends. They built friendships and sharing their experiences. Here's my lived experience. Here's what Michael did to me. Here's what Brenda said about me. And it was so, so bad. Well, somehow that got back to Michael and Brenda. So we have this final service for this couple, and they got to talk for like a little bit of time. And then Brenda got to talk a lot longer about how great the couple was, but how great the church was. And we did such a good job helping them. And it always ended with sheet cake, which was awesome. Big fan of sheet cake. And what do you call it? When you pass the basket, a love offering, right? What a way, what a beautiful thing. We underpay you, but we'll let other people pay you. So Michael came and grabbed me, and he goes, I need you in my office. And I put my sheet cake down. I go to the office, and that person is there that shared those things with their friend. And Michael begins to raise his voice, and he is shaking, and he's holding the check, the free will offering check. And he says, I've heard that you've been talking bad things about me. You have no idea the things I've invested in two of you. You're ungrateful. And if you don't repent, not apologize, repent, I'm going to rip this check up. This person begins to weep. And then, I'm there because I'm loyal. I'm there because I believe that we're doing this in the name of God. And so these red flags were in this place of like, this doesn't feel like Jesus. This doesn't feel like the kingdom of God. This feels like a temper tantrum. This feels like bullying. And you're forcing something on this person. And so they did. They repented. They apologized. And they got the check. And I connected with them years later after I was done at the Duluth Vineyard. And I apologized. I said, I should have said something. I should have stood up. And what they said is, Chris, what power do you think you ever had? Michael controlled that place, and I just needed the money because we're going back to our country with nothing. We wasted 2.5 years of our life. So that was a huge red flag.
power dynamic is definitely a theme that I'm sensing in a lot of red flags that seem to be present before sort of what culminates in this cataclysmic event, whether we're talking about the situation in Duluth that we'll get to, or, you know, what happened in Anaheim and some of the other events that have happened throughout other Vineyard churches that you know, we won't even report on just because there's too many other incidents to possibly cover in this podcast. But one of the themes seems to be that there were signs that were ignored for a number of reasons. And one of the common trends seemed to be that the red flags were ignored in certain situations specific to where there were instances where there were pastors who were very charismatic, who solicited a lot of growth within their church and brought a lot of positive attention in a lot of ways to the Vineyard. And so like the bad behavior was sort of excused because, hey, look at all the great things they're doing at their local church, until it blew up in their face. And then all shit, now we got to deal with this.
See, I would disagree. I don't think it was, what's the word you used, tolerated? It was radically celebrated. These people, these pastors on stage are these dynamic, amazing, seem vulnerable people. As soon as they get off the stage, they would lose their shit on staff members, on volunteers, because it was all about performing, center my pleasure, center what I want to see happen. The number of times that Michael walked right up to into the sound booth, right? We have professionals doing it, and he put his hands on them and push them out of the way and start moving the things because he believes that he's God's given gift to this church. And in the Vineyard, the things that got you like to advance, the things that got you, that's not the right word, how you moved up that shitty ladder was that you worked harder than everyone else and that you could like outperform the other person and you were louder and you were hip with it and wow, more than the other people, which again, just creates this whole system that incentivizes the exact opposite of what Christ is inviting us to be and what to embody. And the Vineyard does some really, really great things. I really do believe that they're making some change in the world. But what they celebrate and what they reward, and I'd say evangelicalism at large, just feels toxic and feels disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah. So talk about, so you're on staff as a pastor. And so talk about when you sort of first came into contact with Jackson.
When I was a youth pastor, I had all three of the Gatlin kids, and the two youngest were, and still to this day, are amazing, great humans. Jackson was always out of control. The first memory I have is we're outside and there's like, I don't know, 100 kids, right? There's way too many kids there. And Jackson is throwing something at someone, and I just asked him to stop. And he looked at me and he was like, "Oh, I hate you." I said, "Get inside." So he goes inside to cool off, and he's a hothead. He is his dad to a T when it comes to that. He can go from like zero to insanely angry in a second. And so I walked into the church to like cool him off. And as soon as I came in, he took a glass bottle and he threw it at me. And it, of course, broke. And I'm like, this is not, what would be the right word? This kid can, like other teenagers, this is not unique just to Jackson, but he can just go on both ends way too quickly. You never know what Jackson you're going to get, because then he started crying. He's like, "Chris, I'm so sorry. Please let me go outside, hang out with my friends." He's probably, you know, 15. Then another time, my brother, who was one of our leaders, again, did something, and Jackson turned around and choked him. And Daniel, that's my brother, said, I knew I couldn't hit him, right? Because he's a minor, but I didn't know what to do. So I just waited until he stopped before he was blacked out. So then I had to go, of course, talk to my boss and his parents. And I have no idea what they did with that. And then, okay. One thing that we had in our youth group that I really loved and instantly regret is we let any of our student leaders, when they were seniors and they were graduating and sticking around, we would invite some of them to come and join the adult team. And it worked really, really well for a majority of them, because these are the people that were deeply invested in the youth group. They knew the culture. They were already leading and inviting people into it and doing small groups. And so it was really, really good. But then when Jackson graduated high school, I wouldn't let him be on the team. But Brenda kept telling me over a dozen times, she'd say, Jackson is made for ministry and no one gives him a chance. Like, it would be random times. We'd be doing like a one-on-one and she would just drop that line. Jackson's made for ministry and no one will give him a chance. And every time I'm like, I don't want this whatever 19-year-old on this team. He's not one. I can't depend on him. And I didn't like him. He was an asshole, right? And so after so many times, and Jackson was still in town, I'm like, all right, Brenda, would you like me to invite Jackson on the team? And I went and talked to Jackson, and Jackson joined our team, helping do worship and be one of the adult leaders. During him as being a leader or volunteer, he acted differently. Like, he was always drawn to kids that were in some sort of crisis, some kids that didn't always fit in. He was moving towards vulnerable kids. That's the best way to say it. He could point them out. He was very good at pointing out. I didn't know at the time. And I'm like, well, these kids seem like they really like, these teenagers seem like they're really connecting with Jackson. Jackson always was a very close, a touchy person. He was that way when he was a teenager. So he'd come up and, you know, put his hands on me and I'd have to push him off. And that's just kind of who he was. And I never put the dots together. I hate talking about this. There were signs that were there, but none of us thought that it was to the level where he was allegedly sexually assaulting these students. And so there was a time where we had a policy you couldn't be alone in a car with the opposite sex if they were a minor. And my entire, 13 years of doing student ministry there, that was never an issue. But Jackson, one summer, I was driving on 9th Street and he came by and he was driving these two teenage girls in his car. Talked to him and he said, dude, you can't do this. It's in our policy. You know this. You understand that this isn't just to protect those girls, obviously. It's also to protect you. And so, like, in the integrity of our church. And he's like, oh, Chris, I'm so sorry. So then a couple months later, 4 or 5 months later, I'm driving by to see him again with three girls in his car. And this time I went to Michael. And I said, this is not okay. I've already met with Jackson once. He's disregarding what I'm asking to do. Like, no one else on our team would still be on this team. But Michael, like, what do you want me to do? Which again, power imbalance, narcissistic leader that created, this is how you do, you report up the chain. I would have done this with anyone else. But because he's Jackson, his kid, I felt like this is what I'm supposed to do. And so Michael said, don't tell Brenda, which again, another huge red flag. And he said, I'll talk to him. I'll take care of it. And that's all I heard. And Jackson was still on the team. And so I assumed that father, son, because Jackson was living there at the time. And I thought it was all going to be okay.
Hmm. So there's a couple like things that pop out to me, you know, again, just from, you know, working in the corporate world my entire life, things that would just never happen in any other business. And yet have occurred here where, like, first of all, you've got a husband and wife who are co-leading an effective business together, which would seem like scream like conflict of interest right out of the gate. And then we have like a nepotism hire where they hire their own child. And you can't, I mean, you know, we're both parents. I can't think objectively about my kid. Like, and I would never put myself in that position to do so, to have to do so. And so it seems like there's already built in, baked in problems to this sort of setup.
Yes. Well, you just remind me, and it was in the report. I don't know if you caught it. When Jackson was no longer working student ministries, he got hired to be the Heroic Leadership Institute, HLI. And his wife was also working as an admin. And then Jackson's brother was also working at the church. And at the time, I was a part of the senior leadership team. And Michael and Brenda were on it as well. And John Kluwer, who is now the lead pastor at Duluth Vineyard, and he has a law background. He's brilliant. And he said, you know, we should have a nepotism policy in place to ensure that if anything happens, right, we're by our bylaws and our policies, we are covered. And it's just wise. Like, Brenda shouldn't be coaching. That's what we call it, coaching. It was just telling. Brenda was coaching Jackson, and Michael was coaching, his kids are everywhere. And as SLT, we talked about it. Brenda cried, and she's like, this is unfair. I'm a pastor, and let me use my gifts, and my kids are gifted, and I can impart wisdom that no one else can give them. She referenced other vineyards. There's another vineyard in Wisconsin that their entire family was the staff. And so she referenced that and saying, look how good that is. And those people are amazing, but like that creates a problematic system. So as an SLT, we outvoted Brenda and we enacted a nepotism policy. John wrote it up. We all looked at it. We signed off on it. And it goes into it goes into the employee handbook. Well, I didn't know, but a little while after that meeting, Michael went to the Duluth Vineyard board or council and asked for an exemption for Brenda and Michael, that they could still coach their kids, and had a whole reason behind of helping HLI explode and grow. And the board approved it, but it didn't tell anyone. And when I met with the team, that the third party that did the investigation, and I told all my stories, the lady stopped and she goes, if the board would have voted that down, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Because if Jackson was doing all these allegedly horrible, evil things, he would have had to report to someone else and they might have caught it. They might have seen it. And if Jackson was only talking about that with his mom as his boss, anything that came up as an allegation, and they did, Brenda dismissed them as, you are demonic. You have mental health issues. This isn't God. And she did it on multiple accounts with HLI students. We wouldn't have this fucking problem if they would have just followed the nepotism policy. But it goes back to the power that not just Michael, but the way the vineyard and their bylaws are created, the senior pastor has so much incredible unchecked power and at the mercy of hoping that the board is going to do something. But when you get to pick the people on your board, you have power over them. Yeah. So that reminded me of that nepotism policy.
That's incredible. And yet again, it's like so common that there was an opportunity to stop this from happening, preventing other victims. And yet here we are, you know.
Here we are.
One of the things that you brought up, which I think is kind of interesting, is Vineyard eventually, so obviously, eventually this comes to light, but what we're talking about are dates that occurred between like 2007 and 2010. That's a while ago. So, you know, I think a lot of people are listening are probably wondering, like, why did it take so long for all of this to come to light?
When I found out, I had a former student contact me and say, can we go out and get a drink? So we go out and get a drink, and they tell me one of their friends from youth group told them a while ago of what Jackson allegedly did to this student. And never told anyone because the friend asked him not to tell anyone. And it wasn't until later that Jackson was moving up into a position and was getting more pastoral authority where he finally felt like, I have to say something. And so that person went to another Duluth Vineyard pastor, and that Duluth Vineyard pastor went over Michael and Brenda and went right to the board. So that's how it all started. When I heard the news, or I heard it that in that meeting, it devastated me. I went into a deep depression. And when victims would contact me, once it became public, I apologized to this one victim, said, I'm so sorry. I'm the one who said it's a safe place. I'm the youth pastor. It's my job to make sure that kids are having fun and it's safe and that the people on the team are all background checked and trained. And I, of course, I'm a high feeler, so I started crying. And what they told me was, Chris, he was hiding in plain sight. He was doing things to me, saying things to me. And I didn't even know that he was doing this with like 11 other girls. So if I couldn't tell, how in the hell were you going to be able to see what was happening? And it was like all for, in most victim stories, right? And I am not comparing at all my trauma to theirs. Trauma's trauma, but like, I couldn't even talk about my own spiritual trauma with the Gatlins until I got out of that system. It was like, I felt embarrassed. I felt stupid. I felt like this is just the Satan trying to take down the church. And so you disassociate with your body and your feelings. And that's what a lot of victims said, is they're like, we didn't want to hurt the church. Maybe I asked for it, right? I replied to the text. And so that's why it took so long. And then allegedly, there's two moms that said they did confront Brenda, and that Brenda dismissed it, saying that you have a needy daughter and she has mental health issues. She has dad issues. And so if that's two stories, how many other stories are out there that Brenda just like protected her kid? Because she told me many times, unrelated to this, but like when it came to school, he would write his papers, she would do his homework, because she's like, Jackson's made for ministry, no one's giving him a chance. And anything that threatened what she believed came from God, right, she would handle it. And she was so good at handling situations, sometimes in a very positive way, right? But clearly she had a different agenda. She had a different intent that she didn't communicate with anyone else.
Yeah, and one of the things that you mentioned, we've had, you know, several conversations before now, just kind of discussing the things that you experience. And one of the things that you brought up, and if I remember correctly, is the fact that beyond just the power that, you know, that Brenda had at Duluth Vineyard, she was also in a role on a much larger level within the vineyard, right? Like, she helped with other potential investigations and that sort of thing. So explain sort of like what that role was and what kind of power she had within that context.
So Brenda was first an area leader, which is like you oversee like your like 10 other churches that are close to you. And you offer like pastoral care and you lead the meeting. But then Brenda got promoted to be a regional leader, which she oversaw several states, which would be, you know, 50 or 60 other vineyard churches. And if anything happened, they'd have to report to Brenda. And Brenda was one of two female regional leaders. And so she, as she should celebrate that. She should own that. A vineyard is a place that, you know, everybody gets to play, but it's like 80% white men that do all the work, maybe probably a lot higher than that. And so as a regional leader, Brenda had so much power over not just what is happening, but the narrative, the stories that would be told, all went through her. In the same way that like that junior high intern couldn't tell their own story, Brenda would retell stories that, funny, the vineyard always came out like really, really shiny, smelling like roses. So Brenda had a lot of power. And then Michael was the National Church Planting Director. So, which was one of the three paid, at the time, only one of the three paid jobs that had a multi-million dollar budget. And so Brenda had the regional power. Michael had, Michael was a National Church Planting Director, but which in a church planting movement is that you're like the fucking coolest guy in the room. And so they had unchecked power at a national level, and they could influence what was happening in Nashville Vineyard.
Wow. So other churches could potentially, and were bringing potential sort of internal vineyard investigations into different allegations to Brenda. And Brenda is the one who's sort of overseeing this. Is that?
I can't speak to anything. I don't have any information of like, hey, this church in Hillsdale, Illinois went and Brenda shielded it. But the way it's set up, theoretically, absolutely. Yeah. Like she could, any crisis that happened would go to, and it's in their policies, would go to the area leader first, and then the area leader would contact regional leader, and regional leader would contact pastor and their board.
One of the things I think that's interesting to me, and like you kind of mentioned this at the beginning too, and I think that's exactly right, where you mentioned the fact that some of the issues that we're talking about are not in any way, shape, or form unique to Vineyard. I think it's probably pretty common. I mean, we've seen, there certainly have been some other documentaries and things that have come out about other evangelical sort of megachurch groups like Hillsong. I think we've probably all seen that in the news. But the common thread throughout seems to be that there's also this issue where sort of what we'll say, God's law is sort of supersedes man's law. And what I mean by that is that in a lot of these situations, as some of these things come to light, a lot of it is sort of viewed as we can handle this internally prior to maybe involving law enforcement. And that seems to have created a large issue, obviously, because some of these situations, like when we're talking about potential, sexual assault or allegations of, minors and that sort of thing, like that feels like the thing that immediately goes straight to law enforcement. And yet in most of these situations, that's not what happened.
No, because when you really do believe that this is like manifest destiny, when you really do believe, and Michael and Brenda did believe it, that we are called by God, and anything that would come in opposition to that clearly wasn't God. When other members or staff members that would quit, and even like that intern I shared about, and they would just speak about their own lived experience and it was negative, they were met with instant shame and instant punishment and exclusion, right? No one on staff who resigned for any reason, or very few, ever stayed in the church. Because once you get behind the veil, you see the bullshit that it is, then you're like, I want nothing to do with this. And so the number of times I watched Michael and Brenda try spinning a narrative, spinning something to always make the church look good, they were excellent at it. So yeah, they in the vineyard and evangelicalism, maybe even other as well, they're excellent at choosing the church over people.
Which seems kind of contradictory to.
Yeah, not a fan.
No. What's interesting, and I want to spend some time talking about this because I think this is important, and it goes back to sort of the story that I'm trying to portray within this series, which is that, yes, it's easy to talk about some of these like very scandalous situations and kind of, you know, shed we'll say negative light on like the Vineyard in this case. But really the story isn't that. These are just byproducts of some of the issues within the system. When, as you said earlier, and I believe this too, I still have friends. I mean, Vineyard is very, very, has a very strong hold on Columbus, Ohio, where I live. Huge Vineyard church where you mentioned Rich Nathan and Jay Pathick, both come from the Columbus Vineyard here. And there's a billion offshoots, you know, church plants around the city. So definitely, you know, very, very popular in my neck of the woods as well. But I know a lot of people who either work to some capacity in leadership or just attend, who are great people, who love the vision of the Vineyard, and, you know, are trying their best to follow the teachings of Jesus and do good in the community and, you know, and that sort of thing, who feel like innocent bystanders caught in the crossfire of sort of this power structure and this ineffectual response to when trauma happens. And so, like, clearly, like, you could have easily walked away. And you mentioned that earlier. Like, you've had not one, but now two traumatic experiences at the hands of the church. And, like, why the hell are you still in church, man? You're standing in a church right now as we speak. It's like, how did you hang in there? And, like, and, you know, and to that point, I also would love to talk about, like, clearly it's had a lingering impact on you. This is not easy for you to talk about. I can see that. And you even shared a story with me about a conference you were recently at and sort of the triggering effect that had. You're still dealing with the lingering effects of this, you know? And so how did you end up remaining within the church, and what sort of impact has this continued to have on you in the years since?
It's because I knew I wanted to sound so cheesy, but I believe in it. I wanted to change the world. I was a seventh grader that showed up at this youth group because my friend told me Christian girls will talk to me, right? And I walk in and the youth pastor comes and looks at me and talks to me. And I grew up in a small town where my dad was the English teacher and I had three older siblings. So adults never talked to me. They talked at me. I was in trouble or they're looking for my dad. And so to walk into this space, just hoping that a girl would maybe even touch my arm, take interest in me, it transformed me. And that youth pastor, Pastor Phil Baker, is the reason I'm a pastor. My dad was an English teacher. My mom was a social worker. So the empathy and compassion and justice was just ingrained in who I am and who I was. And so I became a pastor because I wanted to help other Chris Sodders, other lonely, awkward teenagers with a bad afro who loved Superman, but couldn't tell anyone because he wanted the girls to talk to him, find a place to belong and feel inspired that they could also go and change the world. I still believe that to this day. And so from being in the Duluth Vineyard and the toxic system, being at that first church and then being kicked out of the Vineyard, right? I'm still here because I still believe that the narrative and the person of Christ is still compelling to me today. And I still see in our awkward, small, beautiful, life-giving church that people are still being transformed. And that's something I've given my life to, and I'm going to continue to do it because I deeply believe it.
I love that. I love that. The fact that despite everything that you've experienced, that at the core, you still believe in the original mission and, you know, and the ability for you to sort of separate. And I had my own experience with this as well, very different sort of negative experience, but my dad's a pastor, retired pastor. And, you know, when you're a pastor's kid, you tend to see the politics and that side of things, the very ugly side of church. You're like, I don't like this. And definitely had plenty of opportunities growing up to see the ugly side of things and be like, you know what, I want no part of this. But there's something that always sort of drew me back to it. And it took me a long time, and I'm sure you as well, to be able to separate out the bad actors from the thing itself.
Yeah, bad actors and also bad theology and bad values or unhealthy values, I'd say. And in therapy, one of the most transformative times is my therapist sat me down and he said, and I was 41 at the time, and he pointed the chair and said, pretend that 25-year-old Chris is sitting over there. And what would 41-year-old Chris tell 25-year-old Chris? And it helped me like think through, I don't have to shame who I was. I don't have to shit on who I was. Like, I don't want to go back, but that's who I was. And I love Chris. I love 25-year-old Chris. So I began to cry and just say, you are good. And that dream of changing the world, you're going to continue to do it. Even when you get older, just stick with it. And so in my deconstruction, of course, like everyone else, it started with anger and rage and want to burn it all down. And that happened when I was planting a church. So I'm having all these feelings, I'm having all these questions, but still getting up on the stage and still processing in a healthy way, right? And still creating place for other people to process. So that helped me a lot to not hate on previous Chris. All the other versions of Chris were beautiful, nuanced, complicated, dipshit things, toxic things. So I participated in that system. No one made me. But I couldn't get to where I am now, where I love who I am now, and I love the way that we get to lead this church now and inspire people. So it's just that evolution of we can know better and do better and be better.
I love that. I kind of skipped this part by accident, but talk a little bit about, like, ultimately you left Duluth Vineyard. What was the final sort of straw that broke the camel's back that you realized, like, this ain't getting better, I got to get out of this?
Well, I don't think I've shared this story with you. I'm going to try to make this as succinct as possible. Michael and Brenda came up to Nikki and I and took us out for dinner and said, hey, we feel like God is calling us to move more into a national position, and we feel like we'd like you to be our successors. Which is funny because I never wanted to be a large church pastor. But part of what I love about myself is I'm so loyal and I trust people too much, but I trust people. And so when he said that, it didn't feel right, but I'm like, okay, well, this must be God. And it was exciting. And we had like a 2-year plan, and about a year and a half into that plan, right before Michael got up on stage, like 5 minutes before, he pulled us into what they call the staff lounge and said, hey, God told me that I'm supposed to commit to another 10 years here. I know that's really heavy. I'm really sorry. I have to go on stage. And we felt 30 seconds of like devastation and loss, and then looked at each other and we're like, oh God, felt relief. Cause now like everything was open to us, and we're like, well, let's plan a church. Michael's a church planning director. I've talked about planning a church with him multiple times. And that's how we left Duluth Vineyard, was us planning a church in Cloquet, Minnesota. And we originally had a plan where we would be like Duluth Vineyard South. We were going to be a satellite. And then about 2 weeks before we planted, we did like a large launch where we rented an auditorium and tried getting as many people there to start the church. And where am I going with this? Oh, we had a meeting. Another vineyard pastor planted a church like us. Michael brought in to help like consultate. And he said, do you really want Chris to still be an employee? Do you really want to have like the same sermon series? Do you really want to have the same worship songs? Do you really want like 60% of their money to go into your account? Like, do you trust Chris? And Michael said, yeah. And so 2 weeks before we launch, I have a meeting with all three of them. And they say, here's what we're going to do. You're going to be your own church. We're going to gift you a lot of money to cover your salary for a year and your operating budget. And all we ask, you don't have to pay it back. All we ask is that you plant another church. So that's how we actually became our own autonomous, independent vineyard church with our own board, which that board effectively voted, right, to leave the vineyard. But that's how we got out.
Wow. What was the main reason that the board eventually voted to leave the vineyard entirely?
Well, that's a totally different story. So I say that we voted, and we did. But back up. When we finally agreed to plant the church and we finally stopped working there, and we were out of the Duluth Vineyard system, that's when everything began to shift. Because once you're out of that power structure, you can finally breathe. And you're like, oh, what kind of church do we want? What kind of pastor do I want to be? What kind of marriage do Nick and I want? Do we have to emulate Michael and Brenda? And it was wild because it felt like all this freedom. It felt so good to dream and then like build a culture. We called it build a culture with purpose and on purpose. And so we did things wildly different than Duluth Vineyard. And the way that those values were expressed, they were, to me, funny, I'm the leader of it. It felt really good. It felt really beautiful. And so we started in 2015 and 2018, I personally came to this place of like, I'm affirming, open affirming to the LGBTQIA plus community. And it was scary because I knew this is the one thing in the vineyard that you could get kicked out for. But as you came to the same conclusion, once you know, you can't pretend like you unknow it, right? Once you see it, you can't unsee it. And it felt so good. It felt so alive. It felt so Christ-like. It felt like the Bible was coming alive to me in a whole new way. And it felt, and I had the freedom to like, and I was talking to our church about all these things. And we had a queer couple show up. And like a lot of Vineyard churches, people don't know that the Vineyard has a policy that they will not ordain or let them be pastors, and they won't marry any same-sex people or queer people. And they were shocked once they found out. And they said, so my money has been going to the National Vineyard, which they only recognize my body, my love, and my partner as being sacred. And they're like, we can't like not only not give money more, we can't even come in here. If you were going to be open and affirming personally, we celebrate that. But you are still actively participating in an institution that is harming queer people. And that like totally like, you know, as a middle-aged white single or as a straight man, like it like blew open my eyes of like, oh, okay. So Nikki and I set up a meeting with Michael and Brenda again, because she was our regional leader. Another pastor at Duluth Vineyard was my area leader, and we were a church plant still, and Michael was a national church planting. So all the people that I had to talk to were my former bosses. The power imbalance was there. But I, again, believed that I was no longer an employee. I was equal. Michael and Brenda, Nikki and I, we are all pastors, and we're shoulder to shoulder. And I emailed them saying, hey, we'd like to meet and talk about Vineyard's policy in regards to the LGBTQIA community, and if there's any way that we can stay in. Like, I was the person, like, I'm changing the system from the inside. I believed I could. And the Vineyard did this with women in ministry, where they took a position that women can be, what a blessing they did, that they told women that they could be pastors. They're so great. That they could be pastors and national leaders and all that stuff. But locally, the church got to decide if they wanted to embody that and express that or not. And there was a lot of churches that said, no, women will not be pastors in our community. So in that email, I advocated, similar to that policy, can we do the same thing? Is a room this for queer people? Michael then sent me the Vineyard USA's policy, and he said, I want you to read it all, mark up what you disagree with, which I replied and said, no, I'm not going to do that. When can we meet? It was just another power play to show me how wrong I was. So show up at their house, and we have like 30 minutes of the most awkward small talk, knowing what we're going to be talking about. And we then start sharing. And right before the meeting, you're probably not going to use this, but it's still really funny. We met with other former Vineyard pastors who also got kicked out for the same issue. And they said, only talk about the thing you want to talk about. They're going to throw all these other things at you to try getting to distract you, to try discredit you. Just stick with this, right? Stick with this policy. I'm like, yes. And I sat down in that meeting and Michael goes, and I share how we've evolved in this issue and how it's life-giving. And I think that when we say everybody gets to play in the vineyard, like what if it could actually mean everybody? And then he said, well, if you've changed the Bible on this, where else have you changed the Bible? And I seriously could feel my heart pumping. I'm like, don't say it. Don't say it. I don't believe in original sin. And it was like someone threw a grenade in a... Now we're talking about 6-day creation and we're talking like Noah and the ark and like way too many things. And they essentially just like shamed me saying, well, how can you, but Brenda at one point said, you're not smart enough to be able to make these interpretations. There's people way smarter than you, Chris, who believe that you are wrong. Which in Michael's defense, which I don't know why I have to be in his defense, he did say, Chris is quite well-read and Chris is is not like some moron. But it was all ways to make us feel small and shameless. And we kept saying, we don't want to leave the vineyard. We've given 15 years of our life. Our kids were raised in the vineyard. And at the time, I meant it. We believe in what the vineyard's doing. And we are off on a couple theological views, which I'm okay with. I'm not asking the vineyard to change their policy. I'm asking, can you let us be who we are and trust that we hear God and we hear the Holy Spirit? And their response was, that's great. You can either repent. That's a common theme. You can repent. You could pretend like this never happened and just stay with the vineyard policy, or you can leave. And that's what they gave me as options. That's what my regional leader, and that is what my national church planning director and my former bosses gave us. So when I say we got kicked out, they left us no option. They were not willing to work with us. And I understand all the reasons why an organization, power and money, all in the name of God. And so we held an emergency board meeting and it's funny. We constructed the board with people who were bleeding heart liberals like ourselves and with other people that were very conservative, like way more. And I don't believe conservative is bad or evil. It's just different than where I'm at. And so I thought, Nikki and I said, unless we get 100% participation with the board, with the staff and the leaders, if there's like anyone says, I don't know about this, then Nikki and I said, we'll resign and we'll let Brenda come in and be the new pastor. And the board, I had a 45-minute discussion and every single person said, yes, we believe in this kind of community. Even though one person on that board disagreed with our theological point when it comes to queer people, but said, I've always wanted my kids to be in a place where there can be different values and everyone can still belong. So beautiful. And then with our staff, same thing. We had another staff member that was a different place and really believed in the idea of that we can be at different places and still belong. And then with our leaders, I had one person on the council, on our board, when I told him this, he said, wait, we're not an open affirming church? I'm like, my man, no. He's like, if I would have known, I would have never stepped foot in this church, let alone be on the board of this church. It was wild. It was really, really wild. And so it felt alive. It felt great, but it was also full of loss. And as you've heard all these stories, full of grief. There was people who were very, very, very angry. And I don't blame them. I don't like how they process their anger. I don't care for that. But they're entitled to that. And then we had people who just really wanted to be vineyard. And there's a huge vineyard 20 minutes away. So we lost about half our church. And it was one of the hardest things that we've ever done. But man, it is the most liberating, honest, vulnerable, authentic thing to be able to stand in front of our church and say the real you is never a threat to God and actually believe it. that it can be included and be embodied by just infinite amounts of people. I love that. And it felt for the first time when we went through that of like, I'm not thinking in my head of like, oh, I can't say this because that might mean this. And it's, I can be who I am. And there's a lot of people who don't care for me. I'm okay with that, right? But I don't play the pastor game anymore. I don't play like, I'm going to tell a half truth. I'm not lying. I'm just not going to tell you the whole truth. I believe that's what it means to be a follower of Jesus, that the real us should never be a threat. It might not always be good. It might not always be correct, but it shouldn't be a threat. It should be met with nuance and conversations and the ability to evolve and grow through it collectively.
Yeah. Gosh, it reminds me of a quote I heard once that something along the lines of like the most creative, interesting ideas that pastors come up with are during seminary, because once you're in the church, you suddenly become a business owner and you got to keep the lights on. And so like, to some degree, you can no longer share those amazing ideas for fear that it will affect your bottom line.
And it does. Our business model is not a good one. if you're in it to retain a budget and friends, then hell, don't do what a lot of us have done. Because even I said this to you before, like I don't ever say like give to God, right? It's like everything we do is giving to God, right? We use that as a way to, I believe, to kind of manipulate your spirituality to feel like you have to give to get the best of God. Again, horrible business strategy. But I'm not going to manipulate people. I'm going to try avoiding manipulating people in any shape, way, or form. Because the trauma that was the trauma that was done to me, right? I want a different story for my kids. I want a different story for our church and the next generation.
Yeah, that's great. I love that, man. Just a couple last things that I had on the list here. So to try to cover is... obviously, there's an ongoing court case now with the situation at Duluth. I believe he was indicted on 10 counts and still has yet to go to trial. What has happened in the aftermath of that coming to light and formal charges being filed?
What's come to light in terms of the case, Duluth Vineyard?
Yeah, Duluth Vineyard, I think, is probably the thing that I'm kind of most curious about, because obviously all of a sudden this comes to the forefront and questions are being asked. I know there's an internal investigation that is being done or was done by Duluth Vineyard itself. And then they also brought in a third party group, I believe called Grace, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
To launch an investigation. So obviously a lot of questions being asked. So what has been sort of the result of that?
I everything I know about Duluth Vineyard, since I'm clearly out of it, has come from some staff members, has come from the senior, clearly the new senior pastor, but I can't speak with any kind of authority on it. So could it be hearsay? I'll share it with you, and then you do what you do what you want with it.
That's fair.
And the trial has started. It's just getting hung up on. I've gone to every one. Did I tell you what I said to Jackson?
No.
I'm a very anxious person, so being in that room with Jackson and then also seeing the victims, right, is showing up. I learned from another activist. Activism. The most important thing in activism is that you show up. And so I felt this is how I can support the victims, that I can show. I couldn't show up from before. I can get my ass into that courtroom. And I'm sitting on the edge and I'm sweating and my hands are shaking and Jackson's leaving, and because he's the first to exit. And for whatever reason, he looked at me, made eye contact with me. And the first thing that came out of my mouth, I said, fuck you. Not my greatest moment, not my worst moment. And it just came out. It was so funny. So what happened, from what I know, it's happened at the Duluth Vineyard. Let me see. Is when allegations came out, Brenda denied them. And this is all on their website. Have you gone through like all the emails. So there's the official document. And then if you go to somewhere on their webpage, you'll see it like, see our response to victims or whatever they call it. And then there's like 15 links you can click. And one of them goes through the, with data, and in chronological order, how they handled it. And it's emails that Brenda sent to the board and what the board did, what the minutes were. It is wild. They'll give you way more context than just me. Because they walk through how they let Michael and Brenda go, or they fired them.
To their credit, so, they've been very transparent.
Super, super transparent. I applaud them. There's according to the victims, what they shared with me, there's definitely some room for growth, right? Hopefully this never happens again. So when allegations came out, they did not suspend Michael or Brenda. Brenda was no longer working for Duluth Vineyard. She was employed by the National Vineyard full time, but still had connections to Duluth Vineyard because the way she got paid was through Duluth Vineyard. I don't understand it. It sounds even super sketchy. And then Michael was not a part of any of the investigations. He was not privy to information, but he was still leading the church. And it was Michael who came up with the idea of bringing in that grace team. Michael had some really good ideas with some really well intentions. But when the allegation came out that mom reached out to Brenda, that's when they put Michael on paid leave. And again, had no longer access to be a part of the church or any of that stuff. And then when more and more information came out, National Vineyard suspended Brenda, fired Brenda. But here's the thing, and I don't know if you want to use this or not. In their bylaws, when Michael was fired, or he resigned before he was fired, Brenda became the acting lead pastor, which led the SLT and led the board. Brenda didn't know, but in that short term, she could have stepped in and fired the investigation team. She could have let the entire board go and put other people in. Isn't that nuts?
Wow. I mean, the fact that you can even handpick the board is remarkable, because that also seems like a conflict of interest to me, but yeah. Hey.
Whose interest? They're not worried about other people's interests. So from the conversations I've had with a couple of staff members that I still talk to, is that a ton of people obviously left. But there's still a good group of people that still believe in the work of what the Vineyard was trying to accomplish. A lot of grief. They did a whole series on what's the word when you're grieving? Anyways, Brenda shamed the board and saying, who do you think you are talking to me? I am called by God to lead this church. And now you're putting restrictions on who my son can talk, because they said he can't go to small group. And she's like, he has all these allegations that are not true. Now you're removing him from community and he needs his community. Like, she's just blinded at what really happened with Jackson. And she's still trying to control. And she said, you should let Michael and I take care of this. This is what we do professionally. This is how we've led the church. So she's trying to take the power away from the board and away from Grace so that she can step in and do it. Oh, you're gonna love that, dude.
Wow.
I'll send you the link.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Definitely be taking a look at that. But obviously, eventually, the power does get taken away from them, and law enforcement becomes involved, and formal charges are filed. And like, obviously, there's been a huge cleanup, so to speak, in process, where there's been a lot of like soul searching, and a lot of like, like, how did this happen? How do we allow this to happen? You know, obviously, when these sorts of situations occur, like, a lot of questions are being asked. And to your point, we have 10 counts, presumably 10 victims, but we don't know if there are more than that. Those are just the 10 that came forward. And so you know, it may be years before we finally sort of understand, if ever, like the true impact that Jackson had on, you know, this church and this community. I don't know. And maybe you can't speak to this, and that's fine. There's obviously been a reaction by Vineyard USA. They've put out their own statement. They brought in an investigatory group initially, one that was sort of like, seemed to be more like widespread than just what was going on in Duluth, because they also brought in folks, I know for a fact, that they interviewed folks within some of the churches within Columbus, Ohio, for example, like where I live, you know, and talked to some of the people who had come forward with some allegations over the years here. So it seems like initially they were trying to do a pretty large investigation. Like, we need to look into all of these different allegations from all over Vineyard USA. And then at one point, I don't know how familiar you are with this, they took that original group who were conducting the investigation and sort of scrapped their report. And then they switched to another group called Guidepost. And so Guidepost kind of took over. And there was some sort of potential shadiness going on behind the scenes. I was told by a pastor who's still in the Vineyard that essentially one of the allegedly unbiased third-party investigators sort of watered down the report because, quote, his wife was dying of cancer and he needed the contracts. How can you even make that? You can't even make this stuff up. Like, and so, you know, so who knows to what extent the final report was effective. You know, like I said, I kind of shared with you at the beginning, the very first point on here, and I have it, is, you know, they recommended, you know, formal ordination. And there were some good pieces in there where they were very, very honest about the fact that, like, you guys do not have a good reporting mechanism in place. You need to have access to that link, like large and in charge on the front page of your website, so people know where it is and where to go. It now goes directly to this Guidepost group as opposed to through Vineyard. So it goes straight to a third party. So there are some good things that they've done, but along with that, it does seem like there's a lot of disgruntled pastors who are still within the Vineyard who are seeing them sort of leverage the situation as a way to sort of consolidate power and gain more control than they previously had.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be fair, Duluth Vineyard didn't switch their group. They stuck with whatever that horrible name is.
Grace,
yes. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I went to a whole conference of Vineyard leaders and former leaders where they talked on, I don't know how long we can keep doing this. Like, they're trying to, and I understand why they're doing it. Organizations, if you want to last for several more generations, you have to get more mainstream. You have to become more mainline, and you have to have way more power than what the Vineyard currently has. But for a lot of Vineyard pastors, that's not what they signed up for. They loved the original dream of having a community of churches that are in relation with one another who share similar values. And those people at large disagree and want to have more power, especially after what happened at Anaheim.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, there's a $60 million lawsuit as a result of that church pulling itself out of the Vineyard. And what's interesting to me too, is that all of these things that are taking place and all these changes within the sort of hierarchy and the structure, like, at what point do you stop this facade of referring to yourself as a movement? We're not a denomination, we're a movement. You're a denomination, man. You just use different terms. You have the same structure, the same pyramid structure as every other denomination out there. You can call it a national director or a bishop. It doesn't matter to me. But, you know, and now they've got this handbook that they're creating and formal ordination and all the things that, you know, are in place at other churches. And it's not to say either, by the way, you know, I grew up a Lutheran, that Lutherans are exempt from, you know, from scandal and, you know, and abuse. And certainly, like, we saw this with the oldest of the Christian institutions, the Catholic Church, years ago. So it's like, So it's not to say that like any one Christian organization has done it perfectly or spectacularly. There are issues all over the place, but like, let's stop pretending like it isn't what it is. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a Christian duck.
and I just said this, but like if you're, again, I believe those in leadership in Vineyard have the best intentions and they want, like me, we want to change the world, right? We want to help create disciples, whatever term they use. But when that is tied to money, power, and a whole host of potentially angry people, you're going to continue to evolve to survive. And one thing I learned this from Michael Gallen. He says, every church has a timestamp. Not every church is made to stay open for all time. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. And maybe even in movements, because whatever the Vineyard's doing, I'm happy for them. But what attracted me to the Vineyard was like that high value of relationship and then trust from pastor, pastor, church to church. And that seems like that's evolving into something different.
Yeah. So final thoughts. Like, I just want to give you the opportunity to give you the floor. Anything else that you want to kind of get off your chest in this moment, you know, like, you know, and maybe partly like also, you know, you've got a church now. I think it's safe to say that like you've taken what you've experienced over the years and what you've learned and try to develop a model that is healthier and so that's sort of informed the pastor that you are today. Like you said, you're a very different person now than you were in your 20s. So despite all these negative experiences, not only did you hang in there, but it seems like you've been able to use that to craft, you know, a kind of a different sort of church.
Yeah. How do I want to say this? I would say to anyone who's a pastor or anyone who's attending a church or anyone who's just moving in their spirituality, never compromise your authenticity. Trust your body. And when you begin to have shifts in your theology or your beliefs or your values, it feels fucking scary as hell. Because everything that you handed, everything you're holding, you believed it was true and you got life and friends and money and influence. And when one of those things begins to change, trust your body and trust that, yes, it's going to be hard, but on the back end of it is the most liberating, flourishing you. And not only for you, but there's a whole host of other people who are in the same space as you that are waiting for someone else to speak, waiting for someone else to move, waiting for someone else to act. So trust your body and you will endure the pain. There will be loss. One of the wisest things that Ken Wilson and Ryan Bowers, the drop names, both kicked out of the Vineyard. And they asked me in a matter of 15 minutes when we were going to announce this, they said, do you have 6 months salary saved? I said, do you know what I do for a living? No. They said, do you have a good doctor that you trust? Yes. Do you have a therapist that you use? Yes. Do you have a community of friends that will cry with you and support you? Yes. Do you have access to a lawyer? I'm like, yes. They said, build a healthy team and then go to your doctor when you feel depressed. Go to the lawyer when you're like, I don't know what to do. Like, use those resources instead of trying to play hero ball and just like grind through it. It was so incredibly wise. And it honestly kept me here today by having those resources.
That's great advice. And it sort of reminds me of it, and we can end here, a story that I like to tell when Adam, my buddy who started the Deconstructionist podcast with me almost 8 years ago now, who is a former Vineyard pastor as well. And again, one of the reasons why I know that there are amazing people who formerly were with the Vineyard and are currently still with the Vineyard who are near and dear to me. And so I know that like we can't, my goal for this is not to paint with a broad brush and just say, hey, the entire fucking thing is bad, because that would be disingenuous and it's not true. You know, unfortunately, as is always the case, it's a small few with a lot of power who kind of ruin it for everybody else. And so But anyway, I had this, you know, established this beautiful friendship with Adam through a Vineyard church, and we started this podcast, you know, asking questions and trying to leave space for people to wrestle with their faith and ask questions, whether they're theological or whatever the case may be, but create a place where they're not going to feel alienated or shamed, you know, or any of those things. And so when we first started, we felt very fortunate that we were able to get guests to come on who we had no business even reaching out to, you know, who for whatever stupid reason agreed to come on our stupid little podcast, you know, two bums in a basement in Ohio, you know, and we were so grateful that these people who were, some of which were like best-selling authors and, you know, award-winning, you know, individuals, whatever. We had no business talking to these people. So all that to say, we've always felt indebted to sort of this community that we found. And so anytime anybody would ask us to be on their podcast, if we could do it, we would do it. Absolutely. 100%. Like if you want us to come on, you know, great. I don't know what, why, but sure. So we went on early on and we learned a very important lesson about vetting, you know? So we end up on this podcast and, the story that I tell is it's funny now, but in the moment we were like, what the hell? It was two co-hosts, man and a woman, and we had been in contact with the female podcaster, and she was awesome, super nice, had great conversations where they were like, yeah, sure, we'll do it. We get on, we had no contact with the guy until we started recording, and so she kind of intros us, and then he gets on, and immediately it felt like drive time radio. It was like, hey, you know, and this guy. And he would not shut up and would not let her talk. And it's completely annoying in and of itself. But then he introduces us as, we got Adam and John, the bad boys of Christianity here. Like, what? So immediately I'm looking at Adam, and Adam is just pissed. He's just pissed. Like, what did we get ourselves into? And the first question right out of the gate was, we had hit a vein with something when we first started, because there weren't a lot of sort of deconstruction-esque like podcasts out there at the time. It was like us and the Nomad Podcast, our boys from the UK, and like the Liturgist, maybe a couple others. Now there's just too much content probably out there, but at the time, like we kind of hit a vein, and our podcast kind of took off in a way that we never expected, and so they saw us as a source to figure out how to get more butts and seats. That was their whole goal. Only that, like, how do we get the attention of the kids that you got the attention of and get them to attend our church? And Adam went on this like 20-minute rant about how if that's your goal, then you're doing it wrong. Like the whole goal is just be authentic, follow the gospels, be loving, love everyone. And people will organically show up for that. Because by phrasing it the way that you just phrased it, how do I get people to show up? You are peddling bullshit to people who can see it for what it is. Like you're trying to sell a product to people who can smell a used car salesman, and that's why they're not showing up. Like, just be real, be authentic, admit occasionally you don't have all the answers and that's okay. And like, that's not going to ruin your faith. And people will show up. And like what you're doing makes me think of that conversation all those years ago. So I appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate you coming on and talking to me. So,
well, it's my honor. Thank you.
The views and experiences shared in this episode reflect the personal perspectives of those interviewed and do not necessarily represent the official position of any organization, past or present. This podcast is for informational and storytelling purposes only, and is not intended as legal, clinical, or professional advice. If you or someone you know has experienced abuse in a faith-based context, we encourage you to seek support from trained professionals and survivor-centered organizations. Spoiled Fruit Faith and Power is hosted and written by me, John Williamson, and is a production of John Williamson Productions, LLC. Thanks for listening.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.